This week on the Best of Flashpoints, Kevin Pina reports from the front lines in Port-au-Prince, Haiti, on the 19th anniversary of Jean-Bertrand Aristide's first election to the presidency, as U.S. policy continues to decimate lives and undermine democracy there. We'll also have Haiti Action Network's Pierre Labossière in the studio. Also, Nativo Lopez, president of the Mexican-American Political Association, talks about immigration and healthcare reform and the impacts on the immigrant community. Andrew Caddy talks about how to boycott Israeli apartheid while doing your holiday shopping. And Lars Haltbrekken of Friends of the Earth Norway speaks out at the Global Climate Summit in Copenhagen. All this straight ahead on this week's Best of Flashpoints. Stay tuned.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein, and this is your daily investigative news magazine. We first go back to Haiti. Yesterday was the 19th anniversary, a significant anniversary from the first time that Jean-Bertrand Aristide was elected to the presidency in Haiti. That election changed history, and then it was undermined. Joining us to talk about what's going on in Haiti on the ground now is Kevin Pina. He's in Port-au-Prince, and also in the studio with us is our good friend and brother Pierre Labossière. Always good to see you, Pierre. Kevin, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Thanks, Dennis.
Oh, it's good to have you with us, and we can hear you. We've been struggling all day to get a good line, and hopefully we'll be able to keep the talk going. 19th anniversary since the first election to president by Jean-Bertrand Aristide. What is the significance of that first election? What did it mean?
Well, it's really the first time that Haiti had free and democratic elections. Aristide won by 67% of the vote, the highest plurality of any elected state in the history of the Western Hemisphere. And more importantly, it was the first time that the majority of the poor felt that they had someone who represented them, who represented their interests in the presidential palace, whereas people were even afraid to look at it when they passed in front of it before. They were very proud, and their relationship changed to the state and changed to power when Jean-Bertrand Aristide was elected, because it was they who did it themselves, and they felt that for the first time they were actually participating in their own futures.
And in terms of the election, in the context of the Lavalas movement, let's talk about the Lavalas movement, and even first before that, let's talk about this man, Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Where did he come from? What can you say to help people understand how he managed to rise to power and create one of the most important and strongest parties ever in Haiti?
Well, I mean, he was of the poor himself, and he grew up within the Salesian order. He became a Salesian priest. He was part of the movement that was called Chile Glees, that grew out of the corruption of the hierarchy of the Catholic Church after Duvalier was given the right by the Vatican to be the first head of state in history, the only head of state in history, to appoint his own bishops. The Catholic Church hierarchy became part of the corruption of the Duvalier regime, but at the same time, priests like Antoine Adrien and Father Jean-Marie Vincent and a young priest Jean-Bertrand Aristide began to work with what was called Chile Église, or the base Christian communities that had broken away from the corruption of the hierarchy of the Catholic Church. They brought the drums into mass instead of victimizing and demonizing voodoo. They actually invited drums into their mass for the first time. It didn't mean that voodoo became part of the Catholic ceremonies, but it did mean that they changed their relationship to it in the way that they looked at it. They tried to embrace everybody, but mostly, I mean, it was a movement of the poor, and it was really that movement, which was called the Little Church or Chile Église, that formed the base of the Lavalas movement that ultimately catapulted Jean-Bertrand Aristide into the presidency. Of course, course, the man is extremely intelligent. He speaks several languages. He now speaks Zulu as well. We know that he recently received his doctorate in African languages from the University of South Africa. He's also a man of great courage. He survived, I believe, 5 assassination attempts, including when they burned down his church, his parish in Port-au-Prince, Saint-Jean-Bosco. 12 people were killed. He then was, of course, elected to the presidency, was overthrown September 30th, 1991, in a brutal military coup. 3 years of hell for the Haitian people. They suffered for their choice. Aristide was in exile. And then, of course, he was elected a second time in 2000 and was overthrown in a second coup in February 2004. Again, the majority of the poor who elected him being forced to suffer immensely.
And the Lava Loss, what does it stand for, and what was the vision of it? How did it manage to capture the imagination of the Haitian people?
Well, Lava Loss in English is flash flood, and I'm sure that Pierre can have would contribute a lot to this explanation. But really, you know, it was, again, a movement of the poor. It came out of the struggle and the battle against the Duvalier dictatorship, and it seems to go even further back than that. But really, the seminal moment was in 86 when Duvalier fell. And then, of course, there was an interim government that led to successive military dictatorships, one dictatorship after another. It was really during that period that it was a formative period development for the grassroots movement. As I said, the Tileglise, the small church movement, which ultimately coalesced in coalition with other groups, but really was the backbone of the electorate and is what ultimately developed into what became the Lava Loss political movement and ultimately the Flammy Lava Loss party in Haiti.
Pierre Lebossier, great to have you here in the studio. Always good to see you. Talk a little bit more about Lava Loss and what it meant on the ground.
Yes, a great pleasure to be with you, Dennis, and thank you so very much. I greatly appreciate it. And let me say that your Flashpoints really has been covering the story from the very beginning. You've been on top of it. You've been a great, great, great support for the Haitian people because their voices haven't been out there. And it's because from the very beginning, you've been there, Flashpoints, really doing the great work.
Thank you.
And I'll congratulate my dear brother, Kevin Pina. And I really hope that people really do support this great investigative program because there are many stories that you broke on Haiti, the story of the cocaine and everything else involving the Haitian military and their involvement in cocaine and so many things that the corporate media wouldn't touch, and even the story of the coup. So I wanted to preface my remarks with that.
And you bring it up, and I, you know, it's going all over the place, and the manager of this radio station's got a dear friend to the people. But the bottom line is the budget for this show has been slashed, and it's going to be a real struggle to keep it going. But let's focus, if we could, on Lava Loss, man.
Yeah, no, I hope that doesn't happen, and that you remain and keep doing your work. As a matter of fact, that you should get an increase for the great work that you do. Thank you so much. But to Lava Loss, what Lava Loss means to us in Haiti, you know, there is a song of the movement. It says, each one of us is a drop of rain, but all together we form a flood, a cleansing flood. And in Haiti at the time, and I'm glad to be on the phone, to be in communication with Kevin, also doing great, great work over so many years, has been doing fantastic work in bringing out the story of the movement. And the people of Haiti have really, there were so many different organizations, trade unions, women's groups, peasant organizations, student groups, and they all coalesced. They all came together into this beautiful movement. And the platform is to lift our people from the misery, for the people to lift themselves from the misery that was imposed on them over the many years. And so people came together really with a vision to build schools, to build hospitals, to use the resources of the country, which throughout our history has gone into the pocket of a little elite, a small percentage, very small percentage of the population, less than 5%. And to actually gain control of the resources and to distribute them so that we could have roads, we could have support for the peasants, so they could have equipment, they could build irrigation canals, they could have all the support necessary to grow food for the country, and to have schools for our children. The majority of our children cannot go to school to this day. As a matter of fact, it has gotten worse. You see, so that's what the Lavalas movement means to our people. When you go to a hospital in Haiti, unless you have your own gauze and your own supplies, medical supplies,
sheets, everything,
you don't get that. You see, you have to spend money to get the most basic of care, and many people can't even afford to go. So it's all these things that the Lavalas movement has a platform to bring these, the resources of the country, to provide these things for the majority of the population. And that's what it meant to us when Father Aristide was elected to the presidency of the country. And that's why the people of Haiti also is a very courageous man. He speaks truth to power. He stands up, says his piece very strongly, and it was the first time we were dealing with someone like that in a leadership position that was speaking truth to power and meant it. He stood out there with the people time and time again. And so to us, that's why the people of Haiti to this day, his popularity is ever more. He has much more popularity now than ever before, if you could imagine that. So that's what this means to us.
And, you know, I had the privilege, because of you, to interview President Aristide, and then to go back when he returned, I think it was in 94.
That's correct.
1994. And to walk through the Cité Soleil, one of the poorest neighborhoods in the world, and to see the most amazing outpouring. There's just, I certainly have never seen anything like this. And he certainly wasn't afraid to go out there into the crush of tens of thousands of people and be celebrated, be lifted up. It's just amazing, his relationship with the people.
And also something else I'm glad Kevin mentioned about the National Palace, because growing up in Haiti, the few times that I grew up outside of Port-au-Prince, in a different city, and but every time I would go to Port-au-Prince, you couldn't even look at the National Palace when the Duvaliers were there. I left in 1970. I mean, it would be, you know, Tonton Macoute, you're afraid of Tonton Macoute would be asking you, what are you looking at? You know, are you casing the place or something? So, but when President Aristide, when he was president, he opened the palace to everyone. To everybody, the homeless, everyone. Every sector of the society would come in and have sit-down talks, of chats with the president about what was going on, which direction the country should go, expressing their concerns, their problems, and which way things should go. So it was really, he opened it up to the people. So that's what this elite, both in Haiti and the international elite who continue to this day to occupy Haiti and to oppress our people, to take the resources for their own selves, you know, get more money, squeeze our people to death and make them work for nothing. This is why they don't want this man back in Haiti.
Well, there are a lot of people who do want this man back in Haiti. Kevin Pina's on the ground. He was at a rather large protest action celebration of the 19th anniversary. And certainly, Kevin Pina, there was no shortage of huge pictures, photographs of President Aristide, was there?
Well, there were lots of banners. There were lots of photographs of Aristide being held. There's a new photo, of course, with him in his graduation cap. He recently received a doctoral degree at the University of South Africa in African languages. So there was a new photo that people were spreading around that they were showing to the press. You know, thousands and thousands of people yesterday again took to the streets, despite the fact that the government of Preval did everything that they possibly could to sabotage the demonstration, including spreading money around the poor neighborhoods in order to urge people not to go out and demonstrate. Despite that, thousands and thousands of people still braved and went out in the streets to demand that Aristide be returned to Haiti, that he be allowed to return, but also to condemn the Provisional Election Council, which you have to remember is also handpicked by René Préval, that recently excluded Lavalas, the majority political party, from the political process once again. Lavalas cannot run in these elections, which makes them, of course, not free and fair. They are not inclusive. And there's a good reason Lavalas to run. Because remember that the United States, the Bush administration, and the international community based forcing Aristide out of the country on two assumptions, or two precepts. The first one being that Aristide had lost the support of the Haitian people and was a dictator. And the second, that Lavalas was nothing more than a violent political organization. Well, the truth is, if Lavalas were allowed to participate in those elections, they would win again. And that would give truth to the lie, which is the justification that they gave for ousting Aristide, and that is the one thing they want to avoid at all costs.
And why does the United States spend so much money on elections in Haiti?
Well, to keep Lavalas out primarily is what I can see. Money talks, and, you know, I think I reported to our listeners the other night, more than $7 billion estimated in international assistance from the so-called international community has been invested in Haiti. More than $4 billion of that, more than half of that, has come since Bill Clinton has been United Nations envoy to Haiti. And as I said the other evening, Bill Clinton, for me, is, given that I'm looking at the reality here on the ground, and I see that for that $7 billion, nothing has changed. Quite the contrary, it's gotten worse. I can only call Clinton the consummate con man. I don't know how else to describe this. If you could just compare the propaganda that they're putting out there in the world that's being parroted by the mainstream media versus what the reality here is on the ground, you can't help but feel that this is a con job.
And Pierre, in terms of human rights, are things any better than they've been in the last year or two? Because we know it's been a devastating situation. I know that you get calls from all parts of the country, all times of the day and night, in which people are either in economic trouble or being pursued. What can we say about the situation now?
It's really during the time of La Tortue, which was back in 2006, and 2 years ago, we had spectacular, 2 years ago during the time of President Préval as well, back in February 2007, there were spectacular massacres occurring by United Nations troops. In Cité Soleil, for example, there have been a number of people who were killed. And these, you had described this on your show, and that's why I say hats off to you, brother, for the great work you've been doing covering Haiti. So it's been awful what has gone on. And many of those troops have, not only do they do carry out those spectacular massacres there, but also you've had a problem with sexual abuse of children and young girls, male children and female children as well, using the fact that people are so desperately poor that they will do anything, and they force them too into those acts. So so you've had that situation. Also, I hear a lot from people who are working on political prisoner cases, where the prison conditions are atrocious. And the prisons in Haiti, the United Nations, the premier human rights organization, runs the show in Haiti, runs the prison, even though they like to say, well, Haiti is independent, it's Haitian authorities, but everybody knows that the UN is in charge. They are training the police, they are training those soldiers, they are training the prison guards. And so it's really atrocious. And then that brings up the issue of the case of Lovensky Pierre-Antoine, someone well-known in the Bay Area, human rights advocate who was kidnapped, and he was, it's been over 2 years, 2 years and some months now, and still no word. The UN hasn't said anything about this, no investigation, nothing. So it's, though we don't hear about the more spectacular massacres, we remember during the funeral of Father Jean-Just, how the UN troops fired on the mourners there without any kind of provocation. There was nothing. They started, they provoked something. Still, the people didn't react, and they shot into the crowd, killing one mourner and wounding others. So, and there have been other incidents since that time, including the shooting of a student in Haiti who was demonstrating, and other acts by the UN about a month and a half ago in the south. So these things are being reported all the time. So it's really an atrocious thing what's going on, Dennis.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Burns, and we're going to hold the piece on the Global Summit because we want to talk more about this. We've got Pierre. It's a rare moment when we've got him in the studio, and we certainly want to extend this segment. We've got Kevin Pina, our special correspondent on the ground in Haiti, with lots of dogs, it sounds like. You know, Kevin, when I was in Haiti, one of the things that I did, and Pierre, was go to the National Cemetery where this was after the death squads had done a horrible round of killing, and a lot of their parents were dead, and there were these kids by the dozens, vulnerable. We found them in the National Cemetery, living in various places, sometimes living underground, living in little tunnels, and they were suffering in the context of an AIDS pandemic. So, Kevin, what can we say in terms of healthcare and what people are facing now, 19 years after they thought they were on the mend, they had their president, and it was going to be looking better?
Well, I mean, it seems clear that, they're trying their best to make Haitians dependent. Most of the work of the non-governmental organizations here works on the assumption that they are bringing Haitians something which they are not capable of doing for themselves. And I think that's nonsense. I mean, Haitians were doing it for themselves, and that was the problem. That's what would not be tolerated ultimately, that autonomy of the Haitian people. Today, you don't hear anybody talking about national production. Quite the contrary. It's all very quiet because what they're doing is they're protecting the monopolies of the elite who import food staples such as rice and beans in this country. What they're doing is they've turned reality on its head again, whereas under the Aristide government, the priority was for the majority of the people. Today, the priority is to protect the rights of the elite, so-called private capital, private investment. And their strategy, of course, is to partner up the wealthy elite families with transnational corporations. I mean, I think I've said this before, the Meubs family with George Soros building a $48 million tax-free zone, industrial park in Cité Soleil. You've got the Bigio family being partnered up with the Irish telecommunications giant Digicel. You've got Andy Appeds, who's been partnered up with the largest apparel manufacturer in the world, the Canadian company Gildan Activewear. None of this is an accident. These are the same families that not only supported the first coup against Aristide, but were very much behind what was called the Group 184 that was being used by the Bush administration in order to provoke Lavalas and in order to isolate Aristide's government to justify cutting off aid and to try to create a situation where they could crank up a propaganda machine that transformed the beautiful movement of the poor into a violent movement that they claim was at the behest of a wannabe dictator, Aristide. Today, as I said, healthcare, I can't tell you how many people who were friends of mine need help, just to simply get by. I was last here 2 years ago in December 2007, and prices have risen by almost 40% since I was last here, if I compare them to what I remember back then. And at the same time, Pierre brought up a good point. $3.57 per day, which is what the minimum wage would be, which was passed by the Haitian parliament, is not enough for people to survive on. This is a very expensive country. It's mostly expensive because, again, those wealthy families have made it so. They are being allowed to prey upon the population because they know that Haitians survive primarily on more than $2 billion in remittances that come from thousands of families in the United States, Canada, and Europe. And that money is redistributed into the hands of those few families that continue to control the monopoly on the importation of rice and beans, which everyone must eat. Nothing is talked about for that, and it's one of the reasons that you don't hear about national production anymore. Under Aristide's government, that was the priority. Haitians should rebuild their national production to be able to produce their own food. Today, you don't hear a word about that any longer.
Pierre, people who listen to this story and have asked me, Haiti is such a tiny, poor country. Why would the United States and the West take such destructive action, particularly in the context of a situation where they demonstrated an extraordinary belief in democracy, willing to risk their lives, people with so little, taking so many chances to be a part of a democratic situation? Why would the U.S. and the West take such devastating actions?
You know, I'd ask myself the same question, Dennis, right after the coup d'etat of 2004. And I remember I was talking to my good friend Glenn Ford of the Black Agenda Report. And when I was hearing of all the killings and so many of good brothers and sisters whom I had met who were building schools and their schools were being burned down and their gardens, you know, were being destroyed and all of that. So I asked Glenn for the same thing. So I went into the historical reasons, because Haiti being the first country founded by Africans who had been enslaved, who rebelled, broke their chains and proclaimed their independence and defeated the mighty armies of Napoleon, Britain and Spain. And it was like a severe blow to the whole thing of white supremacy. And it gave a lot of fuel, encouragement to the abolitionist movement. And what I mean by that are also the Nat Turners, people like that, say, yes, we can do it, you know. And also the abolitionists as well, their white allies and other people who believe. And also when you look at the history too, Haiti, the support that they gave to the revolutionaries of South America, Miranda and Simon Bolivar. And so those are some historical reasons. But also, I was talking about, well, that's so long ago. And I know that Haiti also has mineral resources. And Haiti has been a country where the people resist. And as my friend said when she was in town, they insist on resisting so that they can exist. You see, when you resist, they have no choice but to fight. Otherwise, they wouldn't be existing today. And so, but Glenn Ford told me, he said, Pierre, you got to remember Grenada. You got to remember little Grenada.
Right, a country about the size of a whale.
Exactly. And Grenada had only about, 100,000 people. Yet we can see the Reagan administration building up this whole propaganda as if the Grenadian army was going to be marching into Texas.
Well, they had a Russian airport, except it was built by Canada and the British. So there were all those Cubans invading. Oh, that's right, they were doctors.
And then Glenn also mentioned to me, he said, well, during slavery days, somebody would have 500 enslaved Africans on their property, but then they would go after the one who ran away. See, they would mobilize all their forces to go after the one that ran away. So then he explained, and that started making sense. So it's a lot of reasons that go into this. One of them is the money that some of these runaway factories are making in Haiti, those sweatshops. See, rather than paying minimum wage here or a decent living wage, they can go to Haiti and pay, as Kevin's saying, $3.57 for a 10-hour workday. And they don't have to pay any workman's comp or anything. See, it's all tax-free. So it's all in the name of profit. So many reasons that explain what's going on. And Haiti is not the only one. So I want to, again, mention my great support and admiration for Flashpoints, because you bring out this, the same conditions that exist in Haiti. We find them in so many countries all over the world, throughout the Americas and the Caribbean and in other places. It's just that Haiti happens to be, and we are talking about it today, Honduras is a typical example of this, and we see the same pattern.
Barbara Lubin was here the other day and was listening to an earlier report by Kevin, and she was just hearing Palestine all over the story.
Exactly. And one of the songs of the movement in Haiti compares Haitians to Palestinians. And that's way back since the early 70s, that song. And it's one of the favorite songs that many times we sing in Haiti. It's a song of the movement, saying that we are like the Palestinian people, fighting, being oppressed, but resisting the oppression.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We turn our attention back to immigration reform. Maybe I should say, Nativo Lopez, migration reform. And maybe we need to start thinking about this in a much more broader sense. But in any event, it is great to have you back. And I'm talking with Nativo Lopez. He's executive director of MAPA. He is a very significant long-term civil rights activist in the Latino community. And again, we're honored to have you with us. Migration, migration or immigration?
Migration, you put your thumb on it. You know, it's when we think of we're so narrow in our time and space reference, and so we're talking. We think, you know, in the last 50 years, 100 years, etc. But people have been migrating the earth for millennia, right? So I opt, like you, to migration.
All right, let's talk a little bit about migration reform, although that's not what we're going to hear it called in Washington.
Right.
Earlier this week, there were some bills that were circulating around. It's being called reform. Why don't you take a shot at where the action is now? Are you happy with what you see? Are there changes that need to be made?
You know, the title, I don't remember the exact name of it, but it security, protection, and all of that. And so we understand the political context within which this legislation is introduced by Congressman Luis Gutierrez from Chicago, Illinois. It already has 91 co-sponsors. It only needs 218 to pass the House of Representatives. On the whole, I have to say, being very critical generally of legislation that surfaces from Congress related to immigration, migration, political asylum, et cetera, not always what we expect. But on the whole, I have to say that this legislation meets probably 80-90% of our expectation about what is the right way of addressing the issue of status for so many people in the country today and those that would continue to arrive to the United States. There are a couple of provisions that both in on principle we would oppose, and secondly on practicality we would oppose. But on the whole, it's extremely inclusive, encompasses a broad, sweeping swath of individuals currently in the United States. One change alone proposed in this legislation, to be really honest with you, this is something I have never even heard of from the progressive community that's involved in advocacy for immigration reform. But one change alone proposed in this legislation would essentially eliminate, for all intents and purposes, probably 80% and possibly even more undocumented population in the United States. In other words, allow them to legalize their status within a year or 18 months. And that provision that Congressman Gutierrez proposes is that legal permanent residents of the United States who have immediate family members, so we're talking about the spouse and the children of the legal permanent resident, would be able to immigrate to the United States similar to how U.S. citizens file petitions to immigrate immediate family members outside of the per country cap allocation of visas, which is only 20,000 individuals a year, and therefore make the process and the time period by which the individual would have to wait relatively painless and brief. So we're talking about 6 months to a year that those family members would be able to legally immigrate to the United States. If only the Congress was to do that, this would eliminate the undocumented population, and in the future, eliminate the incentives for persons to come in an undocumented fashion. Because if think of it this way, my father is in the United States as a legal permanent resident, and I'm in Mexico hoping to see him someday, he files a petition for me, I can be reunited with him within a year. Why would I cross the border in an undocumented fashion when he would be able to immigrate me essentially within 1 year? So therefore, that eliminates the incentive for persons to not wait. It eliminates the incentive for them to cross in an undocumented fashion, and therefore eliminates the undocumented population that is always used by the right wing as a piñata punching bag against immigrants. So if they were to do only that in his 700-page bill, that essentially would eliminate the undocumented population and much of the vexing political divisiveness that we see in the political landscape of the country.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Nativo Lopez. He is national president of MAPA. That's the Mexican American Political Association. It's one of the most significant Latino, Chicano organizations in this country. And they have been in a pitched battle for the kinds of things that you're now, I guess, talking about. It's wonderful to talk to you about something that might be positive, because the suffering that's going on now among this population is terrible and sometimes lethal. You want to talk about where it is now and why this legislation is so important?
Well, just in one word, I can say that the situation today with the migrant population, the immigrant population, is perverse, you know, particularly under this administration. Never thought that we would be facing the situation that we are today. Every indicator of enforcement, be that detention, deportations, incarceration of emancipated youth, incarceration of minor children, of families, the immigration prison industrial complex growth, all of those indicators, employer sanctioned fines and sanctions against employers, therefore resulting in termination of tens of thousands of workers. All of those indicators are up under this administration above what they were under the Bush administration. So who would have thought, electing Barack Obama as president of the United States, that we would see more onerous, perverse immigration enforcement than we did with George W. So that only makes the case much more urgent for immigration reform. Certainly it's not going to happen this year, but is now definitely going to be on the agenda in 2010, because this legislation proposed by these 91 members of the House of Representatives seeks to fix, if you will, the broken immigration system, allow the 12 to 15 million individuals to legalize their status essentially overnight, allow them to come out of the shadows, integrate themselves into civil society, allow them to work, allow them to travel, allow them to immigrate family members, relatively painless. There are some issues there that we think can be improved to make it look more like what happened in 1986, for example. We don't think that people should have to pay a fine. This legislation proposes a $500 fine. We don't think that people should have to wait 6 years once they obtain the temporary status, have to wait 6 years to apply for permanent resident status. We think that it should be no longer than 24 months, for example. The 1986 experience was 18 months, but 24 months would give the government more than sufficient time to check the background of any applicant to make sure that persons that with a pattern of criminal activity or criminal background is not given a permanent visa. Those two requirements aside, it is very sweeping that would allow persons to essentially legalize their status. Those individuals, for example, from Central America or some of the African countries that have temporary protected status, what's called TPS, would be accorded permanent resident status. So these are very sweeping, progressive ways in which people can be integrated relatively painlessly, even the economy being what it is, because these are people that produce, these are people that are productive, these are generally young people, vibrant, contributing members of our society, and that's all the reasons why we should open the door and allow them to immigrate legally, so that way they can be even more productive members of society.
We've talked about this before, but it's obviously a great concern, and that has to do with medical care. We were concerned because Barack Obama sort of made it part of his stump speech that illegal aliens wouldn't have health care under current health reform if that ever actually happens. How do you think these changes and this bill would deal with this significant issue?
Well, you know, there's a counter argument that I'm hearing now from some folks, and I don't agree with it because it still puts the onus of lack of service on this segment of the population, which they shouldn't be excluded or isolated. But the other countervailing argument is, you know, it's kind of like a perverse political opportunistic argument. Something akin to what Governor Schwarzenegger would say when he's vetoed legislation allowing individuals to obtain their driver's license irrespective of immigration status. His argument is that, well, let's fix the broken immigration system. Let's have immigration reform. All these people legalize their status, and then we can give them a driver's license. So in the area of healthcare, for example, one would argue, let's do immigration reform, legalize all these individuals, and then they will no longer be quote-unquote illegal immigrants, and they'll be then included under the health care reform. A similar argument could be made for employment verification, which is included in this legislation, and on principle we oppose because it basically gives more instruments for employers to discriminate against individuals. It's a system basically that would require all employers to verify any prospective applicant for a job through a government-run massive database of individuals to determine their eligibility to be employed in the United States. Nobody has probably heard this figure that I'm going to give you, Dennis, but we always think of, you know, the big employers, et cetera. There's 60 million employers in the United States. So that would require another bureaucracy. The government itself even admits that its database is faulty. It's not error-proof. And therefore, people would suffer damages. They would be discriminated against. And in this legislation, however, it does include remedies that individuals will be able to sue employers, sue the government, if they are victims of discrimination as a result of employment verification. But my original point is that one would argue, well, if everybody is legalized, who cares if there's an employment verification system, because those individuals would be eligible to be employed in the United States. So let's take that bitter pill if in exchange we can get a massive sweeping legalization program. Everybody gets their work permit, and then who cares that they'll be checked against a massive database. I don't trust government to be managing a massive database on all Americans or folks in the United States, and therefore on principle we oppose those types of verification systems that only give more instruments to employers.
In Berkeley, I'm Nora Barrows Friedman. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We continue our coverage of the unraveling situation in occupied Palestine. In international resistance strategy news, MondoWeiss.net correspondent Ben White writes this week, the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs is sponsoring a conference aimed at, quote, combating anti-Semitism in Jerusalem. White says, quote, it's interesting to see a conference apparently about tackling racism being co-chaired by Israeli Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman. The other co-chair is a Likud MK who lives in a settlement in the occupied West Bank. One of the conference's working groups is aimed at the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. This is from the group's description. Quote, The BDS campaign must be taken seriously, for it seeks to escalate, but we should not be defensive in combating it. As Israeli Prime Minister reportedly said when responding to the UN Human Rights Council's vote to send the Goldstone Report to the Security Council, we are now setting out to delegitimize those who try to delegitimize us. The conference recognizes the urgent need to combat this campaign as earnestly and vehemently as possible. As a result, we have convened this working group to try and come up with imaginative, effective, and successful solutions to counter this evil. We will be focusing on how to analyze the problem in North America, Europe, and the rest of the world, as well as how to play both defense and offense in forging overall strategies. Joining us to talk about this growing boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement that is making the Israeli government very nervous, and how people here in the U.S. can take active and impactful measures to keep their money out of the hands of the Israeli colonial military apartheid state, is Andrew Caddy. Caddy is a New York-based human rights activist with Adela New York and the New York Campaign for the Boycott of Israel. He has written for The Guardian's Comment is Free, The Electronic Intifada, and other publications. Andrew, thank you so much for being with us today on Flashpoints.
Thank you for having me, Nora, and would it be okay to say that Flashpoints is such a valuable resource in the community and as well as to citizens nationwide in this country?
Thank you so much for that. Andrew, let's begin with talking about your reaction as a member of one of the largest organizations in the country involved with the growing BDS movement to the Israeli government's conference on combating what they call anti-Semitism under the banner of fighting the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. We know that J Street, the so-called pro-Israel, pro-peace lobby in this country, has also launched a similar attack on the BDS movement. What's going on here, and what's behind their quick action to try and delegitimize this?
Well, I think certainly the BDS movement poses, as does generally the nonviolent Palestinian movements that are gaining ground, pose a real threat in terms of really bringing attention to what Israel is doing and to gaining a groundswell of popular support, right? They've named this, you know, the BDS working group is part of this anti-Semitism conference, and yet, of course, the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, in terms of as a platform, it completely disavows racism, right? And this is not something that would be part of it. But again, this is the way that they frame things, kind of a black and white version of reality. Obviously, we saw earlier this year AIPAC Executive Director Howard Kaur explicitly stating that boycott, divestment, and sanctions was a significant threat to Israel. And obviously, of course, we see it as a threat to what Israel is doing in terms of occupying the Palestinians and expanding its illegal settlements under international law. So in that regard, I would say that the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, this sort of South African-style approach, has been extremely successful to date and is probably moving at a faster pace than the South African boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement moved.
That's the voice of Andrew Caddy. He is with Adela New York and the New York Campaign for the Boycott of Israel. Andrew, just to recap for our listeners, tell us about the tenets of the BDS strategy as a whole and why it's so important right now.
Sure. So in 2005, the official call was put out by Palestinian civil society. I think it included over 170 organizations, essentially calling for a boycott, for a campaign of boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel, similar to that of South Africa in trying to fight apartheid, and essentially, you know, so the campaign has three tenets, right? And these are the three tenets that Palestinians have called for. They've said that they call for the campaign until Israel ends its occupation and colonization of all Arab lands and dismantles the wall. Right, that would be the wall that was supposedly protecting Israel and running along 1967 borders, but of course is not, as we know. The second was recognizing the fundamental rights of the Arab-Palestinian citizens of Israel to full equality. And the third was respecting, protecting, and promoting the rights of Palestinian refugees to return to their homes and properties as stipulated in UN Resolution 194, which of course is a very simple and reasonable demand in light of the fact that historically all refugees are entitled to return to their homes.
Okay, Andrew, we're in the holiday season. People are out there buying all sorts of stuff for their loved ones, and I'm sure many people would like to make conscious choices about their purchases. Adela, the organization that you're involved in, has been instrumental in putting together a comprehensive list of items that people should boycott as a part of the growing BDS strategy. Talk about this list, what's on it, and why it's so relevant right now.
Sure. I mean, our list is actually Adela New York's list. I think we're in the process of revising, but I will certainly go over a few of the companies that we list, as well as I think it's fair enough to bring attention to companies that others have listed. So obviously, you know, when you're making your purchases this holiday season, for, you know, of gifts for individuals, whether they're family or friends, you know, we're asking people to make a conscious choice, right? And a choice that would not support Israeli apartheid. First off, of course, and this is on the tail of a nationwide campaign, but also a campaign that the New York Campaign for the Boycott of Israel has been pushing, we're asking people to avoid the droid, right? Which is the Motorola droid that has just been released by Verizon. Of course, Motorola is complicit not only in the occupation of Palestinians, but in addition, they are complicit in helping Israel maintain and expand its settlement infrastructure. Motorola actually not only supplies the Israeli army with the Mountain Rose system, which is a secure communication system that they're able to use when they're in the West Bank, Gaza, and possibly even in East Jerusalem, but also they are actually providing surveillance and radar equipment, for example, like thermal equipment that helps to detect, it creates these like virtual fences around settlements, oftentimes settlements that refuse to be protected you know, by a fence, right? Which is, of course, a way of expanding the settlements. So these virtual fences, so to speak, are placed oftentimes probably on private Palestinian land just outside of settlements and are used to prevent individuals from approaching the settlement, which oftentimes, of course, means that Palestinians can't approach some of their own land. So that is there, of course, Motorola is number one on the list. We're calling on people not to buy Motorola products, specifically calling on people to avoid the droid, which is this hot new phone that they've put out. And I think it's worth noting that actually one progressive, and I think the only progressive cellular communications providers called Credo does not even sell Motorola any longer. And I think that announcement just came out recently. So That's one product. Sorry, what was that, Nora?
Was that because of growing public outcry at coming from this BDS campaign?
Absolutely. It's the direct result of this outcry. I believe people brought to Credo's attention that Motorola, you know, is involved, is complicit in these various ways in the occupation of the Palestinians as well as the expansion of these illegal settlements. And so Motorola is no longer featured on the website. I will note that I don't think Credo has issued an official statement, so I let them speak for themselves.
All right, well, let's talk about some of the other items on this list.
Sure. Ahava. It's correctly pronounced Ahava. It is Israeli, you know, they're Israeli Dead Sea cosmetics. They're sold in a variety of stores all around you. The spelling is A-H-A-V-A. And basically, Ahava is 44% owned by Israeli settlements. Those would be illegal Israeli settlements under international law. They have their factory on the settlement of Mitzpeh Shalem. And they use mud from the occupied shores of the Dead Sea in the West Bank, where, in fact, Palestinians are not even allowed to, you know, they can't go to the Dead Sea in those locations, despite the fact that those are, you know, those are that's on Palestinian land. There's an active campaign against Ahava. It's Code Pink, Code Pink's campaign. And so I would direct people to the Code Pink website, which is specifically for Ahava, which is stolenbeauty.org, where they can kind of get more information about it. But again, so far we have the droid and any other Motorola products, as well as Ahava, Dead Sea Cosmetics.
My name is Lars Holtbecken. I'm the chair of Friends of the Earth Norway, and I'm also part of Friends of the Earth International. Earlier today, when Friends of the Earth delegates arrived at the COP15 in Copenhagen, we were denied access to the center. And we are surprised and shocked that Friends of the Earth member groups from around the world and other non-governmental organizations have been denied access to the negotiations this morning. Our organizations represent millions of people around the world and provide a critical voice promoting climate justice inside the UN building. But we were denied access this morning, and we've been given several different, not very good reasons for being denied access to the conference. There was also a walkout from the conference today, but Friends of the Earth could not participate in that because we were thrown out of the conference.
Let me follow up on that now, Lars. You said you were giving many reasons for not being allowed in. Why don't you just give us a couple of the reasons and tell us why you think you weren't allowed in, what the real politics is here?
First of all, they said it was security reasons. Then it was some fire security reasons that they could not allow more people into the building. But while our people were sitting outside, they allowed other people and other NGOs and parties and observers to go into the building. So that was not a very plausible cause for not letting us in. We also were told that the reason for not letting us in were that we did not have our so-called secondary badges that you needed today to get in. But actually everyone from Friends of the Earth International that came today had their secondary badges, and there were no one from Friends of the Earth inside the building when we arrived. So that was not a good argument either. And the reasons for doing this, you should actually ask the UNFCCC why they throw out a large environmental organization and also other observer organizations.
Let me jump in here. Could you describe, just give us a sense of the kind of work you do and what you think they were trying to exclude, the kinds of issues they were trying to exclude by excluding you?
We are working for a ambitious and fair climate change agreement where developed countries must cut their emissions a lot, and where developed countries also must transfer financial resources from north to south for adaptation and mitigation. And we try to bring climate justice to this conference, which is a hard demand for some of the parties at the conference who probably would like to see a deal sealed behind closed doors. And there are a lot of NGOs that will have their present at the COP15 limited over the next 2 days.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking to Lars Haltbrekken, and he is with Friends of the Earth Norway. They were prevented from going into the climate summit today, given a series of reasons apparently that don't make sense to your organization. I guess it's the largest environmental organization in the world. What's at stake? What's the bottom line?
The bottom line here is that we're trying to fight for a ambitious and fair climate change agreement. We now see heads of states coming into Copenhagen to seal a deal. But what we fear is that we will have a deal without the correct numbers for reducing greenhouse gases. We will not have an ambitious deal that will solve the biggest problem that humanity faces in these days.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows Friedman. Our contributing producer is Robert Knight, and our technical director is Eric Klein. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera, Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and the Block Report contribute to this program. To comment on today's program, please contact us at dbernstein@igc.org. Look us up on the web at www.flashpoints.net for our archive shows. Dozens of affiliate stations across the country broadcast Flashpoints on a regular basis. Please email us your call letters and Flashpoints broadcast schedule at dbernstein@igc.org, and we'll add you to our website. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening.